groceries at no charge at the HWMA's Hawthorne Street Transfer Station from December 26th through January 11th. Residents are encouraged to recycle their Christmas trees so they may be processed into useful mulch or compost. To prepare Christmas trees for recycling, please remove all decorations, including ornaments, hooks, garlands, tinsel, and lights. Flocked trees may not be recycled. And now it's time for Heroes and Patriots. Thank you so much for joining us.
Like there's no one to blame for the dead and impoverished in your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket.
Good morning and welcome to the program. This is Heroes and Patriots, a program about national security, intelligence, and foreign policy. Today is Thursday, December 4th, 2025. We are coming to you live from the studios of KMUD in Northern California. I'm Mary Massey, joined by co-host John Sakowitz. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mary, and good morning to our audience listening to the broadcast on their radios live here from Northern California, and for those across the country listening to the web stream. Three quick housekeeping items. I want to point out that that we hope to be scheduling a very prominent Native American writer on our show in the very near future, Dina Gilio Whitaker. She just wrote the book, Who Gets to Be Indian? Ethnic Fraud, Disenrollment, and Other Difficult Conversations About Native American Identity. This is her second or third book, and she teaches in California as well. And she owns a consulting company, the DGW, for environmental justice on Native American lands.
Super.
Very, very excited about that. Also want to point out that yesterday we heard that a very important figure in the Iran-Contra affair died recently. Eugene Hassafus died. He was the pilot of the CIA-backed supply plane that was shot down in Nicaragua in 1986. We're going to be talking about lies with our next guest, Matthew Ho. The whole Iran-Contra affair was just a shocking package of lies, which is why I mention it. Final housekeeping item, please support this station, KMUD. I am writing an end-of-the-year check of $100 to the station. That's probably way too little considering all that they've done for the show. I hope Mary matches me, Mary.
Yeah.
And we want you to support this station, particularly in the context of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting being defunded by the Trump administration. So please support KMUD and the very hardworking staff here. Thank you.
Throughout this program, we invite you as listeners to speak with our guests today on topic. That number to call, 707-923-3911. And our engineer, Cece, will be routing your calls and add you to the conversation. Cece will be routing your calls. Getting a little feedback, Cece. There we go. That's better. Okay. In this first segment of the program, John and I will speak with Matthew Ho, as he mentioned. Matt is one of the many former military, intelligence, government officials, and journalists featured in the new documentary, Bodyguard of Lies, which can now be seen on Paramount Plus. John and I screened that and found it amazingly powerful, upsetting, and provocative. Captain Matthew Ho is presently senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network. He is a former U.S. Marine Corps captain and State Department officer. He is an Iraq War combat veteran and Afghan War State Department officer. In 2009, he resigned in protest over the continued escalation of the war. He became a whistleblower only to be met with threats and pushback from the Pentagon. And we'll be talking about all that. But let's first welcome Matt back to the program. Hello, Matt. We don't have your mic.
Yeah, sorry. The dog was barking, so I was trying to be a good guest and mute, and then you forget you've muted, and right? But it's good to be here with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
We have one going on in our background, so forgive us if you hear Leo.
Hey,
yeah, this would be Alex or Kanga. So, yeah.
Hey, Matt, you weren't any Marine Corps captain. I mean, you weren't any captain. A, you were a Marine Corps captain. And B, weren't you captain of a headquarters company for the Marine Expeditionary Force in Kabul?
No. I had a commanded a combat engineer company in support of Regimental Combat Team 7 and 2 in Anbar Province in Iraq, 2006, 2007.
Yeah,
and you're a decorated Marine as well, and a disabled Marine. Is that correct?
Yes. I have a disability from my time in the Marine Corps and from the wars. Among other things, the three signature wounds of those wars. So post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and moral injury. So the three invisible wounds, the signature wounds of the war. I have them like so many hundreds of thousands of others.
But before we launch into the subject of today's show, which is the documentary Bodyguard of Lies on Paramount Plus, and because we have so many combat vets listening to the show, explain what moral injury is and how the VA has now made that, you know, an official diagnosis for a disability.
Right. So moral injury is essentially the wound that comes from when you transgress your morals, your religion, your ethics, who you thought as a person. So it is the shame, the regret, the guilt that comes from doing something or failing to do something that you would have believed you would have done, again, in accordance with your moral values, your ethics, who you were taught to be, essentially viewing yourself not as the hero with the white hat, but the villain with the black hat. And that existential spiritual crisis, that crushing of your soul is incredibly powerful. This, if you look at studies, research that has been done for decades, one of the best predictors of suicide in combat veterans is combat-related guilt. The first time the VA identified that was in 1991 in a study of Vietnam combat veterans, where it said clearly the best predictor of suicide in Vietnam combat veterans is combat-related guilt. And so this crisis, this darkness, this existential peril that you're in is nothing that can be diminished. And for people who may be struggling with understanding how strong of a force that may be, I'd remind you to revisit, say, Shakespeare's Macbeth with Lady Macbeth, who kills herself because she can't get the blood off of her hands. And I'll remind you as well that she wasn't the one who held the dagger. And so this type of spiritual, mental, emotional toil on combat veterans is something that according to the studies, according to the literature out there, the leading cause of suicide in combat veterans. And moral injury is also something I should say that's not confined to the veteran community. Anyone can experience moral injury. You see high degrees of moral injury in law enforcement and first responders. You see high degrees among healthcare workers, you know, and other occupations.
Right. And the way it plays out is depression, anxiety, PTSD, alcoholism, addiction, suicide.
Failed relationships.
Incredibly failed. I mean, one of the biggest things, and I'll talk about this because I know we do have a good number of veterans listening. One of the biggest intimacy is a thing that it kills. And so you have a lot of issues of sexual dysfunction, of inability to be intimate with partners, of a coldness, of a separation from those we love. And so you see that very often in the veteran community, very high rates of divorce. And, you know, when you drill down into that, some of that comes from a loss of affection, a loss of intimacy, an inability to be close to your partner, an inability to have sex with your partner. I mean, that's what occurred to me. And, you know, I mean, just to be a bit open here, you know, I'll see photos of old girlfriends I had from that time who I had stopped having sex with. And I'll see them now and how attractive they were. And you'll say, my God, there must have been really something wrong with me, right? I had stopped having sex with these women. But, you know, I mean, but that's, you know, being glib a bit. But the reality is that type of inability to be intimate with a partner goes back. The root cause of that is the shame, right? It's the shame that you feel that leads into all kinds of issues of trust, all kinds of issues in terms of maintaining relationships, right? And then that feeds that into anger, feeds into depression, despondency. You have sleep disturbances. I mean, people can imagine how that cycle then builds, right? That snowball rolls down the hill and grows. And then from that, it just ripples out and affects everything. So of course, your partner, of course, your family, and then of course, work relationships, school relationships, family relationships outside the home, relationship with neighbors. You can see how the consequences of this become severe, not only for the veteran, but for everyone around him and her.
And that brings me to the next question. Do you feel that these veterans and their family members, are their wounds are being met? Is the Veterans Association and others
treating them
adequately?
There's been a great deal of catch up to be done. Up until about 10 years ago, this concept was ignored by the Veterans Administration. It was roughly about 12 years ago that the VA did a study basically asking themselves, should we be asking veterans about the effect of killing? Right? I mean, you can imagine that. God, it wasn't until in the last decade that the VA didn't start asking veterans whether killing somebody had an effect on them. Right? And you would take these batteries, you take these, you know, you go through the exams, you meet with therapists and counselors and psychologists, and they wouldn't ask you about whether or not you'd taken part in killing, whether or not you'd, you know, and what that gets to then. And the VA since has begun programs to address that. They've had a program out of San Francisco now for a number of years, essentially called Effects of Killing. But, you know, that gets, you know, why is that though? Why are they so reluctant to ask about moral injury, and in particular to facts about how killing, you know, taking part in killing, either directly or indirectly, affects somebody. You know, this is a political thing. I mean, you can't tell the American public that these wars are righteous. You can't tell the American public that these are wars of good versus evil, that they are moral necessities, existential necessities for the country, and then say that our soldiers, our Marines, our sailors, our airmen are coming home and killing themselves because of these wars. Can you imagine somebody from the VA going in front of Congress and saying the reason why our veterans are putting guns in their mouth and blowing the back of their heads off is because these wars were unjust? Because what they did over there was morally reprehensible to the veterans. I mean, you can't imagine a congressional hearing where that's something like that is allowed. So the politics of this, and this is that why this whole aspect of the thank you for your service that dominates our society, that ritual obligation that all Americans are expected to perform when they hear a veteran, thank you for your service. The degree of disservice that does for veterans, because it eliminates or it crushes any ability to have honest conversations about what took place in these wars.
Yeah, maybe the best question is, how are you doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I've been, I'm well. Thank you for asking, Mary.
In general.
Oh.
But that's okay, Matt. You can talk to us.
By the way, you look great. We're doing this. And you never look better, buddy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your service. How are you doing?
You know, and
how are you supported?
Certainly, you know, I heard this from Vietnam vets. You know, they would say to each other, welcome home. You know, but those type of more candid, honest questions, as opposed to that rote, ritualized requirement to say thank you for your service, you know, that would be, I think, much more welcome than many veterans. And there have been polls out there and studies and, of course, anecdotal stories about how many veterans do not like being thanked for their service.
Right.
You know, one final thing before, two final things before we move on. Besides the thank you for your service, one thing that Vietnam vets say at the VFW hall a lot is, it's a phrase I hear over and over again, is it ain't over. It ain't over. Yeah. It ain't ever over. The war for them ain't ever over. You hear that at the pool table. You hear that at the bar knocking down
beers. What do you mean by that, John?
That their war is never over.
Inside,
you know, that's and the other thing I wanted to point out is we've had Colonel Stuart Schiller on the show,
right?
the Marine battalion commander who spoke out against the screwed up evacuation of Afghanistan at the Kabul airport. And criticized the his chain of command for being basically dereliction of duty and having having so many Marines and others killed. And he pointed out that moral injury can be caused by not just what you do, but what you fail to do. And in his case, had he failed to protect the Marines under his battalion command by speaking out about how his commanders were just so irresponsible, he just said he would have taken it to the grave. And it cost him his marriage. It cost him his career. It cost him his pension. You know, I've only written to President Trump once. As you can imagine, he and I don't share a whole lot. But I wrote to him and I said, you've got to give Colonel Schiller a job. And
he may not want one with Trump.
No, no, he's working for the for the Trump administration now.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah, and maybe that's the one good thing Trump has done. I don't know.
I mean, Stu Scheller, I haven't spoken to him in a few years, but knew him several years back, particularly when he was enduring his celebrity of being persecuted for speaking out and calling for accountability. That's essentially, as far as I understand, what Stu was trying to accomplish was get some degree of accountability. I don't think he was saying we should stay in Afghanistan forever. I think he agrees we needed to get out. It's the fact that getting out was so poorly done. And you can say that about the whole entirety of the war or 20 years. But the spectacle that occurs at the very end is illustrious, right? That's a really exemplary image that's seared in our minds. That is the finality to that 20-year-long occupation. And the fact that it was so disastrous in many ways. I mean, you can point to things, you know, we airlifted 100,000 people out in a matter of days. I mean, there were some things that were done that were quite impressive about it. But overall, I don't think anyone's saying anything other than that this was a catastrophe.
Right.
And how come then no one is held accountable? And I think that's a great segue, right, to talk about the war in Afghanistan, because you can't even have anyone held accountable for that spectacle that occurs in August of 2021, let alone for the entirety of the war, which was, you know, unwinnable, counterproductive, immoral. It could be argued at times illegal as well. But certainly this idea of accountability is one that I think, you know, regardless of anything else Stu Scheller ever does, his right. demand for accountability for what occurs in August of 2021, you know, God bless him for it.
Yeah, it's 17 minutes past the hour. If you would like to join the conversation, we're going to be talking about the documentary in this next few minutes.
And Mary, we've never talked to a guest for 17 minutes off topic ever.
But it is on topic.
But that is to the point that Matt Ho is not just, you know, a leading thinker,
advocate,
but just a real humanist, you know, this whole issue of combat vets suffering not just from PTSD, depression, but also of moral injury, I think is something that deserves 17 minutes of this show. Thank you, Matt.
So, if you'd like to join the conversation, 707-923-3911. We ask that you be on topic. Okay, Bodyguard of Lies, the title of the documentary. Is understood late in the film exactly what it's referring to, and there's a reference to Winston Churchill. And Matt, I wonder if we could just start there, and what did he say? Obviously, this was during World War II. How does that go with what we're talking about today? Bodyguard of Lies.
Right. Thanks, Mary. The that phrase, Bodyguard of Lies, comes from a statement Winston Churchill makes during the Second World War, where he says, sometimes the truth is so precious it must be protected by a bodyguard of lies.
Wow.
And if you step back or maybe you dive into more of what Churchill was getting at into the context, he was talking about the timing of the D-Day landings. That's a truth that's so precious we must lie about it, right? I mean, he's talking about the tactical and operational realities of the war and how you can't let the enemy know what you're doing.
Right.
What the Afghan war, as depicted in Bodyguard of Lies, and the utilization of that phrase, what you see is the American White Houses, successively four of them, the George W. Bush, the Barack Obama, the Donald J. Trump first administration, and the Joe Biden administration, find that the idea of a bodyguard of lies is not purposeful or meant to protect our troops from the enemy, but rather to protect the White House and policymakers from the American people.
Exactly.
And this is something that is not uncommon in warfare. There is the widely attributed to Isocles phrase that in war, the first casualty is truth. Neil Shaheen, in his book, A Bright Shining Lie, which, you know, just as an aside, when people over the years have asked me, what book should I read to understand the Iraq and Afghan war? I've always said David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest and Neil Shaheen's A Bright Shining Lie, two books about the Vietnam War. But I said, if you read those books about Vietnam, you will understand America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Shaheen, after he was a New York Times correspondent who covered the Pentagon Papers in particular, said what he learned from that experience was that classified secrets held by the U.S. government were not meant to protect the American people from an enemy, but rather to protect the American government from its people.
You yourself appear in the film along with a variety of others who have bring different things to the table, in particular the Washington Post. There were former veterans. You know, could you just kind of give us a structure as to what they were doing? How it's laid out beautifully, and it covers a timeline, which is very helpful for those of us who were younger or, you know, could never really know fully what was going on and what was their upset about.
So the film is a short film. It's 90 minutes, and it chronologically goes through the 20 years of the war and details the lies that were presented to the American people. And then they have folks like myself and others, former generals, the Special Inspector General of Afghan Reconstruction, people from Afghanistan, to provide the color, right? To explain this is how the lie worked. This is why they carried out these lies. So the purpose of the lies, of course, was to allow the war to be sustained, was to allow the war to be maintained. Right. As well as to when Barack Obama comes into office to escalate the war. You know, we have a massive escalation of that war beginning in early 2009 under the Obama administration, where the total number of American troops, NATO troops and contractors go from about 70,000 up to almost 250,000 by the summer of 2010. I mean, so a massive escalation and we're spending $120 billion a year. I mean, this is no small affair. We spent $300 million a day for 20 years on this war. So the fact
that Matt, say that again.
How much?
For 20 years, the United States spent $300 million a day on the war in Afghanistan for a total of more than $2 trillion. Yep. 2.4 trillion or something. And that in those numbers, when you know, Mary, you guys know this, when you start talking about these wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, the larger global war on terror to include Syria and Libya, Yemen, you know, et cetera, Somalia, it's really difficult to pull them apart. You know, but the folks at Brown University's Cost of War Project have done an incredible job pulling that apart. And so we can understand that out of the $8 trillion that was spent on the global war on terror from 2001 to 2021, about $2.5 trillion was spent on the war in Afghanistan, an equivalent amount on Iraq, and then the rest of that money throughout the world, and much of it going to enrich weapons companies, banks, contractors, development firms, consulting firms, et cetera. So when you look at that $300 million a day for 20 years, much of it supposedly to rebuild Afghanistan. The line is that, you know, reconstruction in Afghanistan was unsuccessful, but it was very successful in Northern Virginia and in Maryland. And if people know those areas, they know the explosion in growth. They know the construction boom. They know how those areas have been transformed in the last 20 years. These wars make Washington, D.C. the wealthiest part of the United States. Prior to about 2004, 2005, the wealthiest parts of the United States were always places that were understandable. Silicon Valley, New York, Dallas and Tulsa during the oil boom, right? But starting around 2004, 2005, the wealthiest part of the United States becomes the Washington, D.C. suburb. And when you dig into that, you understand that the reason for that is the trillions of dollars we are spending on the wars and how that money doesn't just go to the Pentagon and then to the weapons contractors, but that money, of course, is spread throughout through all types of you know, other organizations, other industries, et cetera.
Yeah, that's why they call them the Beltway Bandits.
Right.
I want our audience to appreciate that. $5 trillion spent in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And again, both wars based on lies. There were no weapons of mass destruction.
There was no government.
We'll get to Afghanistan in a second. In Iraq, there were no weapons of mass destruction. That false intelligence, you know, we've had Ray McGovern on and all kinds of credible guests. That and false intelligence was ordered up by the White House like they were ordering a Hawaiian-style pizza. They literally ordered up false intelligence to predicate the war. I mean, you know, Valerie Flame, just, you know, Google up her story. These are super credible people. We always knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. In Afghanistan, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, passed through, but where was he found? He was found in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. So you have $5 trillion, thousands of American lives, you know, spread out over 40 years, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, based upon lies. So we've interviewed Bob Gates when he was promoting his book on a book tour years ago. And he shockingly said, and very matter-of-factly, war is a business and business is good. Right. War is a business and business is good. Matt, just talk about that for a little bit, and then talk about the other business, the business of lying. So we know defense contractors, you know, feed off of the war machine. But who are the institutional liars? Who profits
Where does it start?
Yeah, where does it start? Who does it? Why is it intergenerational? Why is it institutional? How did it get so embedded?
Well, let me first, because I've got it handy, actually. Let me first read what Smedley Butler said about war and how war is a racket. General Butler, the most decorated Marine in history, received 2 Medals of Honor. If the rules were different back then, he would have received 3 Medals of Honor. But this is what General Butler said about war. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. Is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and in losses in lives. Yeah. And how spread out that racket is. So people are familiar with the term military-industrial complex.
Right.
And, you know, and our friend Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, he used to provide the daily briefing to George H.W. Bush. Ray has expanded that term, and he uses the term Mickey Matt, which, let me see if I can do the whole thing. The military-industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academic, think tank, and technology complex. I mean, that gives you an idea of how widespread, how broad the actors are in all this, the recipients. When we talk about $8 trillion spent on the global war on terror over those 20 years, or if you pull back and say, what was the entirety of Pentagon spending? That was $16 trillion from 2001 to 2021. $16 trillion in Pentagon spending. More than half of that goes to the weapons contractors. So $8 trillion went to the weapons contractors. Of that $8 trillion, about half of that went to just 5 of the weapons contractors. I mean, so you start to understand just, you know, the stakes that are involved here, the enormity of it. The actors that are involved in this go beyond, you know, John, as you were saying, the usual suspects. So no surprise that Lockheed and Raytheon like war. No surprise that as news of possible peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine emerge, their stock prices go down, right? You know, but there are others out there who benefit from this, whether it's the fossil fuel companies. ExxonMobil, their biggest customer is the Pentagon, right? You know, it's the media industries that have relationship with the military for reasons of self-interest. So certainly people have seen the relationship between the news media and the military. The way that they so the last 20 years, the news media has so willingly embedded themselves into the U.S. military and given the military essentially the ability to regulate what the media says. You see the retired generals on your news screens all the time. So when something is occurring regarding the military or war or foreign policy, who do they turn to? Well, they turn to some retired general who's right. also sitting on the board of directors for the weapons companies. Right. So the whole thing is corrupt.
They're yeah. tired of that business.
Banks too. We were talking to
banks. Absolutely.
You know, yeah. we were talking to Oliver Stone, and you know, he told us the other part of the General Smedley Butler story too. General Butler was recruited by the banking industry and other power elites during the Great Depression to overthrow FDR. You know, Oliver Stone did a whole short documentary in his The Forgotten History of the United States on exactly that topic. And who are those families? The Walker, Prescott, and Bush families.
Right, that's right.
The direct descendants of the president's Bush.
We have a call now, John.
This is shocking. I want to pull my hair out.
The whole movie is quite shocking. Let's take that phone call right now and see what their question is. Caller, if you're listening, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point out exactly what that gentleman just said, that, you know, those bankers back in the day, and they were also part of the Fascist Party of America.
Right.
This was another thing, and they supported Hitler 100%. It wasn't just the bankers. There was Henry Ford. There were several others that were involved in big business, rearming Germany at that time during the mid-30s, because they were getting so much money. Okay, and they were part of the Fascist Party of America, and it never went away. It has gone underground. It has metastasized. It has influenced everything in America. And I keep getting, as a former service member, I keep getting people telling me, thank you for your service. And I'm like, dude, I didn't have to kill people. Don't thank me for anything.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and that's what I tell people. I said, if you're thanking the service members for going overseas and killing for oil or killing for big business. And you ask, where does it start? Well, a big part of it starts in congressional districts with our representatives and our senators, because what happens is they vote for all this money going to the defense, or now the War Department, which is a laugh. And then what happens is those companies turn around and fund their campaign contributions. So it's a self-licking ice cream at that point, okay? It's a big circle jerk of money. The same thing happens with the money we give to Israel. A lot of that money comes back into Congress and the administration, whichever one is involved at the time or in power, and that money funds a lot of what happens in our campaign elections. The same thing with Ukraine. They're talking about $50 billion. And I think that's a drastic undercount, has been right. washed through the Central Bank of Estonia and been corrupted and stolen right off the bat. And like I said, it's a huge undercount. And
well,
I'm very glad that you people are bringing this up. Unfortunately, it's not going to get as wide a play as it actually should, because yeah. everybody... And when I say everybody, I mean all of it. Like you said, the media, the think tanks, the academia, all of these people are involved, and they're all getting a cut, and it's a huge grift. And thank you for this.
You bet, and thank you for calling in, and we're glad to hear you are a veteran, and hopefully this can help you get your message out as well. Matt, could you respond to his call?
Well, it's certainly the role of the banking industry in all of this, whatever industry you're talking about. You know, when I was in Afghanistan, you know, it was apparent the role of the international banking industry in the Afghan drug trade. The Afghan drug trade, which, of course, and is now being reluctantly admitted by the United Nations and others, was not controlled by the Taliban, but the Afghan drug trade that facilitated the worldwide heroin a crisis, including the opioid crisis that, you know, has been raging throughout Europe and the United States for the last 15 years, right. facilitated by the enormous growth, the explosion in Afghan heroin, Afghan poppies and opium. And it was always one of the great lies was that the Taliban are behind it. There's this narco-terror nexus between the drug trade and the Taliban. And when you were there and you had access to the intelligence, as well as just if you had a brain in your head and you could look around and understand how things worked, the Taliban weren't involved in that. The people controlling that drug trade were the very people we have put in power. So in Afghanistan, such as you had Muhammad Atta in the north, you had Gul Urga Sharzai in the east, you had Hezbollah Akhundzada in the south. You had a man named Marshall Fahim, who was such a drug lord, such a war criminal that the United States couldn't turn a blind eye to him. That's how bad he was. Yeah. He was the Minister of Defense. And so what do you think happens when you give someone who's a major drug lord planes and helicopters and all the authority of a Ministry of Defense, right? I mean, and of course, the most glaring example was President Hamid Karzai's half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, who was in charge of the drug trade in Kandahar, making him essentially the largest drug lord in Afghanistan. And by, of course, then by extension, one of the largest drug lords in the world. Getting back to the banking, there is no way the international banking system was not involved in an industry that large. And even we see it here today, the amount of transactions, the cash, the money, the laundering that goes on, the American banking industry is fully involved in enabling the drug trade in the Western Hemisphere. There's no way it could not be. Right. I mean, so you see how expansive this all is. But there's, you know, and now, of course, I think you'd add into that Mickey Matt term, you'd add in private equity, because private equity is now the newest player in the national security establishment.
Right.
But I want to get to one other point, though, is that the war wasn't just confined to Afghanistan. And I know you guys talk about civil liberties a lot. And you cannot look at the last 25 years of the erosion of civil liberties in the United States and not understand that the narrative behind it, the reason why it was allowed, was because of these wars, because we had to keep ourselves safe. We had to take our shoes off at the airport for how long? Because there might be terrorists coming. And so all of this was tied together. You don't have a Patriot Act without having an Afghan war. Right. You just it's not possible.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That by extension, then what you now see, and to get back to that caller who just, you know, really appreciative of all that he said there, he really nailed it. You now have this aspect of with the technology companies and their role in national security and how that impacts civil liberties. And if you look at what any of the leading technologists, any of these the leaders of these companies, whether it's Larry Ellison, who now owns CBS News, as well as TikTok, right? Whether it's Peter Thiel, Palmer Luckey at the drone company Anduril, Alex Karp, probably the most egregious of all this at Palantir. You see what they say about surveillance. You see how they see themselves as being the right people to come in and help the government police its population. As well, if you ever go and you look at the tweets from a guy, again, like Palmer Luckey, who is the head of Anduril, this up-and-coming drone company, you know, just the frothing at the mouth at the possibility of, say, war with China, right? I mean, so not only are they fully in favor of the erosion of civil liberties here at home, they are greatly in favor of more war overseas, including ones that would be disastrous, like a war with China.
Matt, our next guest, Daryl Cotton, is going to talk about that hijacking of civil liberties. Mm. One of the things, again, that Oliver Stone pointed out in conversations with him is that the Homeland Security Act and all the legislation that followed 9/11 was actually drafted by an entity called Project for a New American Century before 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, everything that robbed us of these civil liberties going forward was actually in the pipeline before 9/11. 9/11 was the trigger, but there was a plan to claw back our civil liberties way before, the towers came down. And, you know, unfortunately that, you know, landed you in Afghanistan and others in Iraq and Afghanistan and soon Venezuela, I suspect.
Yeah.
This was a very well thought out, premeditated strategy by somebody to claw back civil liberties and for power elites to consolidate power. Just why don't you comment on that? And then why don't we wind up by just talking about where we can see your documentary, Bodyguard of Lies?
Sure. The power that comes from war, the authority that is granted, the emergency authority, I think, is the actual maybe technical term that they would use for it in the government. But the overall reach, scale, scope of the powers that are bestowed upon the executive in terms of war is something that anyone who rises to that level can't ignore. And this is why Karl Rove is so delighted with the idea of running George W. Bush in 2004 for re-election as a wartime president. Not just because the idea, the imagery of the war, of success overseas, like he's some returning Roman general receiving a tribute in Rome, which essentially this is, you know, you can draw a straight line, you know, from that to now in terms of the public perception and the manipulation of the public for these purposes. But, you know, this idea, it's not just going to win him votes. It's the power it's going to give you as an executive. You know, the late Dick Cheney, certainly his ability to expand his control, whether it's his personal control or the institutional control of the executive, completely enabled, enabled in a way in which they actually received authority from the Congress to do it. The power of this is so great that there is hardly any resistance to it. And then, of course, you see that with a Democratic administration and Barack Obama. Not any clawing back on this, not any pulling back, not any limitation on government's authority, but rather an expansion of it. And you know, talk about civil liberties. You can't get to this moment in time now. I guess I'll just end on this because this is the topic of the day. These illegal strikes on boats in both the Caribbean and in the Pacific by drones, you can't get to this point without the precedent set over the last 20 years. So without the precedent begun under the George W. Bush administration with their initial use of drone strikes, as well as the whole overall disregard for international and federal law, right, including things such as a torture program, stellar wind surveillance program, et cetera. But then, of course, the Barack Obama administration massively expanding the drone program, you know, to include doing strikes on first responders, to include doing strikes on funerals. You know, you can't get to this point without having those precedents set.
Yeah.
And so that's the one thing I think is the right place to follow up on is that if you don't go back and correct the not just the policy, but the infrastructures that allow for these crimes to be carried out, whether it be war, whether it be drone strikes, whether it be assaults on civil liberties, then you're not doing anything to preclude it in the future, right? So I'll wrap up with that because I know Daryl's waiting. So the film is Bodyguard of Lies. It's available to stream on Paramount Plus. And I think it's a very effective and powerful film, particularly for people who may not be so familiar with some of the things we were talking about today.
Right.
Matt, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I want to share something with you. And I don't mean this gratuitously. I mean this very, very truthfully. I, and Mary can attest to, I hike every day for an hour along the Russian River where I live. It is my time for prayer and meditation. I do it in total silence. I don't do it with anyone. Last night, I did it under the full moon. We have this gorgeous full moon right now. I hiked under the moonlight. And I want you to know that I keep you, Colleen Rowley, Ray McGovern, Norman Solomon, I keep a pantheon of angels and saints in my heart when I walk. I pray for you and for your colleagues every single day on my hikes. I pray that you continue to speak truth to power. I pray for your health, your physical health, your mental health, and your happiness. I want to thank you so much for what you do for America. So much, Matt.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, John. And I appreciate very much what you guys do. So thanks, Mary. Thanks, John, for having me here today.
Good.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Matt.
Happy holidays.
Okay, we are 44 minutes into the show. We kind of cut into Daryl Cotton's segment, but it's not too late. Excuse me.
Civil libertarian, Daryl Cotton.
Daryl, you know, I want you to introduce yourself to our audience because you're the first time, this is the first time you've been our guest. And I know you're affiliated with the, is it 151 Farmers, correct?
Yes, correct.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. Yeah. What do you do? And then we'll get into.
Yeah. And how, you know, transition segue from, you know, our last guest, Matt Hodes, talking about our erosion of civil liberties and how that plays out in domestic policy and in particular here in Northern California on cannabis policy.
Agreed. And thank you again for having me, Mary and John. I really appreciate it. Matt's a wonderful patriot, and our country's blessed to have him and voices like yours and so many others that realize what's happened to us cannot go unaccounted for. And sometimes we're unwilling to face the facts that we have to come together and have a response to this. So much of what Matthew gave us was, you know, the national and international implications of the drug wars and how it vis-a-vis affects our military responses and that big military industrial complex that we're all familiar with. But I've looked at it as the standpoint of, you know, urban farming and how can we bring a message of renewable farming techniques that conserve water, provide jobs, and do all the things that I knew because we do all eat, you know, bind us together. And that is, you know, we have to get organically grown food and find jobs and find ways to contribute back to the community. But when the community, led by local government, we'll start there, is dead set on taking those rights away, and they're doing it through these cannabis licensing processes from what I'm most familiar with. And I think I've lost count as to how many people that have tried to do things properly and get licensed and do this through the new administrative regulations and application processes that exist since the passage of Prop 64. And it's not limited to just Northern California and San Diego. I've been fighting this for 8 years because one of the things that absolutely binds a lot of these problem issues to the point to where people just give up. They walk away from the application, the license, they lose their entire generational equity and their land, or whatever they might have in savings. And then the small amount that do get licensed, relatively speaking, you know, are they even realizing the profits that made this worthwhile? So, you know, we have to look back and see what did we buy with Prop 64? And as it stands today, where are we? Well, a lot of people, the vast majority, are not happy. And there's plenty of documentaries, excellent documentaries, that would suggest that, you know, this is being probably managed as kind of like a black market operation out the gate, you know, where our local governments are being bribed. They're pay-to-play corruption. And it really takes the citizens coming together, those have been impacted, and say, how do we respond to this? So I would like to just focus on that for the limited time I have. Sure. I want to make sure that people understand you're not alone. And the people that did this have to be held accountable. I mean, failure is not an option when it comes to cannabis or our civil rights. And fortunately, after all these years since the passage of Prop 64, there's cases, federal cases, not state court cases, because they tend to just get clogged up in the system. And by design, the plaintiffs, those who would charge government or private parties with some kind of transactional failure that caused them damages, will find that they'll run them out of money. I mean, the technique is, the strategy is to just continue to litigate until there's nothing left to litigate. I mean, they run out of money and they can't fight it any longer. And the courts kind of go along with that because cannabis is this new law. Well, with the benefit of hindsight, now we have cases that have one in the Central District. It was a private party by the name of David Jew versus the city of Baldwin Park. And when that got heard in the Central Division, that was just adjudicated after a two-week jury trial. And the people that were involved with the licensing and the kind of hide the pee situation, because these licenses right from the start are a scam. It's a scheme to award a license to somebody that's already been pre-approved. And when you look at all the people that will challenge or at least aspire to get this license, and only one's going to get it because of land use issues and so on, then these non-refundable application fees just evaporate. They're lost. So the Baldwin case is good because it held accountable the city manager and I believe it was the city attorney, and they both ended up being brought up on federal charges in addition to the civil charges. So Baldwin's a relatively small case. It's $1.9 million in damages. But what it did expose is the horrible underbelly of corruption that exists at these local government levels. So what I would ask people to do is if you've applied for a license and you find that you were probably treated indifferently, they put too many hurdles in front of you and they weren't necessarily streamlining the process, then your little spidey sense has already gone off. What do you do about it? My suggestion is this, because I'm a pro se litigant, I've been fighting in federal courts and state courts, and I've realized with the collection of people that we have now, it's important that we come together and share these experiences for the purposes of getting them in a federal court under a mass tort. A mass tort means you can come into it unlike a class action, but every party has unique individual causes of action, right, which the courts can hear. But in the interest of economy, they'll understand that these civil rights violations that we're talking about, which Matthew alluded to, can be addressed under one common argument, which doesn't, what it does is it cuts back on court, conserves court resources, because those arguments are given amongst all of us across the state. But these individual issues on a mass tort mean you can say, well, I was affected by such and such. And when that party under the color of law becomes a local government official or an agency that has denied you those civil rights, then like Baldwin Park, they will be held accountable.
So do local governments deliberately mismanage the whole cannabis permit process? I mean, is it just plain old incompetence? You know,
no, I would say incompetence until you prove otherwise. So PRA. Respond to a Public Records Act within 10 days or ask for extensions. And what you'll get, for example, when you want to know the permitting history of a project, which I have people up in Mendel right now dealing with this, and the Mendel County agencies that regulate cannabis licensing can't come up with any of the documents that required those people to be vetted and then awarded the licenses. All right. So it's, what's critical is we have to look at it from the standpoint of what they're giving you under a PRA and what they're claiming they no longer have. Because when Prop 64 was passed, remember, they were telling us that everybody was going to be vetted. It was going to improve our environmental issues. It was just this big kumbaya thing. But Prop 64 barely passed. And again, with the benefit of hindsight, now we've got to look at those agencies that were entrusted to enforce CEQA, our environmental laws, and then the awards, so that there wouldn't be these monopolies, and those that would be licensed would be vetted. Gentlemen, Mary, that is, everybody is suffering under this. Even the people that got the licenses are wondering what they actually worked so hard to get, unless they're involved in black market.
Is Humboldt doing a better job, Humboldt County?
I would say I don't know specifically across the state. I'm in San Diego, so I can tell you that I have absolute evidence of the corruption that exists in weekly payments between $10,000 and $20,000 cash money that went to certain people in our government that then awarded those licenses. But what happens years later, now those same people will say, well, you got dirty hands, so I don't have to pay my taxes. I don't have to abide by these rules because you, the city, and those within it that succumb to this, have dirty hands, unclean hands. So they can't, the cases are being dropped. Right. And what happens then? They retaliate against me because I'm bringing this message up and I refuse to make it go away. I will not do it.
One of the things that came up with Matt is that, you know, war is a business and business is good. And we talked about the military industrial complex that includes, you know, much more than military contractors, but technology companies, banks, you name it. It's, you know, the trickle down from, you know, what was it, $4 trillion that we lost
in those two wars,
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Unaccounted for.
Okay. So the conspiracy theorist in me, and I also worked in law enforcement at the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office. The conspiracy theorist in me says that who benefits by the deliberate mismanagement of kind of the cannabis permitting process? Why is the black market, why is everyone now going, either leaving the business or going into the black market? And the conspiracy theorist in me says, well, it supports the local law enforcement industrial complex. that the sheriff's office in Mendocino County, you have Comet, you have Camp, Humboldt, you have the equivalent institutions, Lake County, the same thing. You have a whole industry, and it's bigger than a cottage industry. You have a whole industry of law enforcement that is predicated on, you know, busting the black market. And that's a lot of money. And that may be one of the motivations to deliberately mismanage Prop 64.
Well, you hit on some good points. So Prop 64, as it exists, it's overtaxed and overregulated. And when you look at how black market has come together and decided what part of the country would handle the black market cannabis and the fentanyl and precursors that are coming in, you have to understand that at no point was cannabis under license meant to be profitable. So what we're seeing is basically with the a huge development of black market grows, it's impossible to be policed and taken and eradicated because they keep popping up. And what it takes there, there's very small fines in comparison to what they're doing, but there's human trafficking, there's the effects on our environment. What we've got to do is come back and engineer it, not from the executive, not from the legislative, because those have failed us, but from the judicial. Give us a chance to come at it from that standpoint, and we expose these things, much like we did Baldwin Park.
Is there a legal counsel organizing or generating a mass tort? Because you alluded to that in the earlier.
Okay, so finding lawyers that you can trust for an individual class action like this has been difficult. But I think as a mass tort, we'll find that they can more specialize in their individual clients and then bring this in under the umbrella of 42 U.S.C. 1983 and 1985. These are RICO and conspiracy charges that the courts must hear. They must deliberate this. And getting it in front of a jury means, just like Baldwin Park, we can be heard as a mass tort as opposed to just individually going through our life savings trying to litigate these things.
Yeah.
Darryl, why don't you wind up the show by telling us how our listeners can contact you, find out more about your work, particularly on the abridgment of civil rights and the body of lies that has hidden all of this from the public discourse.
Well, I would encourage the listeners, if you haven't seen it yet, Jorge Ventura, I think his name is, he documented in the Narco California, and I could be wrong on that, but it's a Daily Caller link. And we know the problems, but what most of these documentaries have failed to do is look at it under the spotlight of judicial recovery. And Baldwin Park, I keep pointing to that. They did an excellent job. And this attorney, a small attorney, fought hard and hard and hard against Baldwin Park. They threw everything at him, yet he prevailed in front of a jury because the jury is where we beat this thing back. And I can be seen at 151farmers.org. We have a section called Can Agreed that goes into all the documents that I've created. Well, I've cataloged them there from these various cases. What we need, though, are attorneys that are not afraid to go up against those local governments, because a lot of them make their living, you know, in front of local governments one way or the other. But this is almost, you know, pulling the nuclear pin here, because you're going to end up exposing the crime, the corruption that exists that pays for the beach houses, the cars and everything else that these select individuals get involved with. And then eventually there's no going back. They cannot make it right. They have to continue to suppress it. Our job is to spread sunlight. It is the greatest disinfectant on these activities.
Darryl Cotton, it's been great for you to be here for this first time in Atlanta. We got to have you back because we kind of inched our way.
Yeah, we encroached on your time, and we'll have you back, brother.
All right. I appreciate it, guys.
I want to wish you a happy holidays, and I want to remind our listeners that today I will be sending out a $100 gift to KMUD, because guests like Matt Ho and Darryl Cotton come to us through this wonderful community resource staffed by very, very few low pay people and just an army of volunteers. We are absolutely critical to the kind of programming that you just heard this hour. If you like this program, if you want to hear more from guests like Matt Ho from the Paramount Plus documentary, Bodyguard of Lies, and Darryl Cotton, an important civil libertarian in the cannabis industry, please support this station, KMUD. You can go online, make that donation. I'm going to get my check in the mail today. I want to thank CC for engineering the show. I want to thank everyone from KMUD for your support this year and to wish them a happy holiday. Thank you so much, KMUD.
Boy, you're slick.
Thank
you. You investors in hate. You Saddams and you Bushes. You Bin Ladens and snakes. You billionaire bullies. You're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war. You old feudal parasites. You just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but you're scared.